Well, what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Lori London reporting. Hillary Clinton gets a coveted endorsement. Testifying to Clinton's grit and experience, President Barack Obama endorsed his former Secretary of State's bid to succeed him and urged Democrats to line up behind her. The long-expected endorsement was delivered via web video.
So I want those of you who've been with me from the beginning of this incredible journey to be the first to know that I'm with her. I am fired up, and I cannot wait to get out there and campaign for Hillary.
Well, the endorsement was part of a carefully orchestrated campaign aimed at easing Clinton rival Bernie Sanders toward the exit and turning fully to the fight against Republican Donald Trump. Sanders emerged from a meeting with the president, saying he was committed to that effort.
Donald Trump would clearly, to my mind, and I think the majority of Americans, be a disaster as president of the United States.
Trump reacted to that and more on Twitter by mocking President Obama's endorsement of the presumptive Democratic nominee. Scientists say the monstrous El Niño weather pattern is dead after 15 months. Defined by warmer than average Pacific Ocean water, it was one of the three strongest El Niños on record and was linked to crop damage, fires, and flash floods over the past year. In the U.S., it did deliver much-needed rain and snow to California, but failed to end the state's four-year drought. Americans' household wealth rose in the first 3 months of this year as home values increased, offsetting a drop in stock prices. On Wall Street Thursday, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down 19 points. The S&P 500 was off 3, and the NASDAQ Composite lost 16. You're listening to VOA. An American citizen who fled the United States and joined the Islamic State terror group before claiming to have undergone a change of heart is back in the country to face terror charges. VOA's national security correspondent Jeff Selden has details.
Muhammad Jamal Kawais, a 26-year-old American from Alexandria, Virginia, was flown back to the United States from Erbil in northern Iraq on Wednesday, and he appeared in court on Thursday afternoon. He came into the courtroom. He looked a little bit bent over, a little tired, a little ragged. He looked at his parents, the first time he's seen his parents since he left to join the Islamic State back in December of 2015. They waved at him. It was a preliminary hearing, though. They set two new hearings, a detention hearing for in a week and then a probable cause hearing in 2 weeks. By his own admissions, he purposely left, sought out the Islamic State to join, had a change of heart and left. But it will be interesting to see how this plays out because it seems like there could be ramifications on many levels.
National security correspondent Jeff Selden. Several suicide attacks killed more than 20 people Thursday in the Iraqi capital of Baghdad, despite the traditional truce for the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Thick clouds of black smoke poured from vehicles that caught fire following the explosion of a car bomb in Baghdad's eastern district of Al-Jadida. A second suicide car bomb blew up next to an army checkpoint in the northern Baghdad suburb of Taji. The car bomb attacks Thursday coincided with the ongoing government offensive to recapture the Islamic State-held town of Fallujah. Edward Uranian, Cairo.
Costa Rica is putting the finishing touches on the largest hydroelectric power project in Central America as the last generators come online. The dam is expected to produce enough electricity to power about 525,000 homes. The country has now reduced its reliance on fossil fuel-burning plants by 90% and says it hopes to use such plants only as backups. Costa Rica has been shutting down some fossil fuel generators, but it does remain to be seen how drought or climate change could affect the energy output from the big dam projects. The dams have also been criticized for their efforts on the ecosystems of the nation's rivers. Here in the U.S., the annual 4th of July concert outside of the U.S. Capitol, organizers announced Smokey Robinson, Kenny Loggins, and Gavin DeGraw will headline the event. I'm Lori London in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Friday, June 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan's president defends why he prefers a Truth and Reconciliation Commission rather than a hybrid court.
The situation in South Sudan is very delicate. The people you would want to take to the court are still armed. And once they know that they are not protected, they are armed, they may cause havoc.
Atten Wek Atten is spokesman for President Salva Kiir of South Sudan. Liberia touts strengthened surveillance for being declared Ebola-free again. Ghanaian women are branching out into male-dominated industries. And Zambia's government denies President Edgar Lungu is ill.
It is not true. It's a malicious statement, and we are very disappointed that the Post newspaper, which is supposed to be the most credible newspaper with the most experienced reporters, is the one that is in the forefront spreading these malicious falsehoods.
Frank Bualia is deputy campaign manager for Zambia's ruling Patriotic Front Party. Cape Verde wants to achieve 100% reliance on renewable energy. And boxers in Washington, D.C. remember the legacy of Muhammad Ali, who is being laid to rest today in his hometown of Louisville, Kentucky. Those stories plus Marco Oman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir is defending an opinion piece published in the New York Times, which calls for a truth commission instead of trials for abuses committed during the country's recent civil war. But spokesman for former rebel leader and current first vice president Riek Machar, listed as the co-author of the opinion piece, says Machar did not write it and does not support the creation of a hybrid court. Jason Patinke has more for VOA from Juba.
Earlier this week, the New York Times published an op-ed bylined South Sudanese President Salva Kiir and his rival-turned-first vice president, Riek Machar. In the article, they appeared to argue against creation of a proposed court, composed of both national and international elements, to try perpetrators of atrocities during the past 2.5 years of civil war. Kiir's spokesman, Atten Wek Atten, argues establishing a hybrid court would push the country back into violence.
The situation in South Sudan is very delicate. The people you would want to take to the court are still armed. And once they know that they are not protected, they are armed, they may cause havoc.
But justice is a key demand of many South Sudanese people who survived the war. Rights activist Edmund Yakan said the op-ed is an attempt for war criminals in government to avoid justice. He said if there is no justice, abuses will continue.
That confirms to me how they, as a politicians, are using violence as an option of buying power. Because if they could believe that use of violence is not an option of buying power, they could have really promoted justice so that in future, others will never use violence as a way of buying power. But I think because now they have the power, so they feel there's no need for justice.
Feelings for justice are particularly strong among Machar's supporters, who say they were targeted by Kiir's troops. Juba University political science professor Jacob Chol said if Machar is against the hybrid court, his followers would abandon him.
So if you say that, look, I want to leave justice, they will say, look, then you're not a serious man. They will look at him as a liar and bad politician.
Machar deputy spokesman Nyerji Roman accused Kiir's side of submitting the story without the vice president's approval. Kiir's spokesman Atten admits the president and Machar did not write the op-ed, saying it came from his office with help from international public relations experts. But he insists Machar approved the article. Roman said the former rebel side, called the SPLM in opposition, will cooperate with any court process.
If there is enough evidence that can link any one of SPLM-IO members to any crimes against us like humanity, then we will hand them over to the court.
The New York Times has not responded to VOA's questions about how the article came to include Machar's name. Regardless, Professor Chol says the episode reveals problems of mistrust between Kiir and Machar, who joins in a unity government in April. Chol also says the fact the government stands by the op-ed shows they may fear an international court could succeed in prosecuting some of their members.
So there's a lot of worry from the government perspective that the court is going to take a lot of people in there.
For South Sudanese, the debate about justice for war crimes is far from over. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Juba.
Zambian President Edgar Lungu is said to be in good health and still campaigning for re-election ahead of the August 11 general election, despite local media reports that poor health has forced him to seek medical attention in neighboring South Africa. Frank Bualia, deputy campaign manager for the governing Patriotic Front Party, says reports of the president's poor health are a ploy by detractors to undermine Lungu's re-election efforts.
We are very shocked because President Lungu has been enjoying very, very good health. Nevertheless, we are not, in a certain sense, entirely surprised, as if by way of paradox, because the media house, the Post newspaper, which has published the same story today, has done it in a manner that clearly shows that their intention is not to report the truth, including about the health of the president, but to mislead the world and the Zambian public, that President Lungu should not be voted for because he's unwell, because he's sick. It is not true. It's a malicious statement, and we are very disappointed that the Post newspaper, which is supposed to be the most credible newspaper with the most experienced reporters, is the one that is in the forefront spreading these malicious falsehoods.
Father Bualia, on another note, the UPND, the main opposition party, has challenged President Edgar Lungu's asset declaration as not completely true. What is your response to that?
Yes, the UPND in this country has always used the strategy of projecting their own mistakes, their own inadequacies, onto another political party or political leader as a way of diverting attention from their own mistakes, inadequacies, and corruption. And this leader, Mr. Againde Ichilema, is on record. So he publicly said he would not make the mistake of declaring all his assets, claiming that if he declared everything that he owned, government would pursue him. Now, that is totally illogical. If government wanted to pursue Mr. Akainde Ichilema, they would pursue him on the basis of what he has declared. If he didn't acquire this wealth dubiously, why would he fear to declare everything that he owns?
The UPND has also stated that the current high poverty levels in the country is as a result of what the party describes as President Edgar Lungu's poor leadership qualities and inability to resolve challenges that Zambians face. Your response?
There is nowhere in the world where poverty was eradicated or poverty was drastic within 1 year, 4 months. So when they blame President Lungu for the poverty in the country, they decide to deliberately forget that the man has only been in office for 1 year, 4 months, somewhere there. How, even if he were a magician, would he reduce poverty in Zambia to levels that UPND says is acceptable? In fact, as far as we are concerned, there's no such a thing as acceptable levels of poverty.
Frank Bualia is the deputy campaign manager for Zambia's ruling Patriotic Front Party. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Lusaka. Liberia is crediting strengthened surveillance and response capacity for again being declared free of active Ebola virus transmission by the World Health Organization. Liberia first declared itself Ebola-free in May last year, but the virus flared up again three times, most recently when a woman contracted the virus after traveling to neighboring Guinea and infecting her two children. Tolbo Nyeswa, Liberia's Assistant Minister for Preventive Services, says being declared Ebola-free, even though this is the fourth time, proves Liberia can contain the virus.
Oh, it means that 42 days has come and gone after the last confirmed case was discharged from the ETU in Liberia, so there is no human-to-human transmission of antivirus going on in the country.
Considering that this is, I think, about the fourth declaration since Ebola came to Liberia, what is Liberia going to do or is doing now to make sure it remains Ebola-free?
It demonstrates our capacity with active surveillance response capacity, building our laboratory system to detect, prevent, and respond to flare-ups of Ebola cases. And so we heartily surveillance and collecting information and responding adequately to not only Ebola, but other diseases of outbreak potentials that we call infectious diseases and disease of epidemic potentials.
So you are crediting Liberia's active surveillance for making possible this declaration?
Oh, yes, because we were able to quickly detect the three cases. We killed two, the 7-year-old boy and the 2-year-old. Unfortunately, their mother died from the virus, but we were able to cure the two children, and we were able to carry on swift response and put this under control. So we again reached the 42-day mark of two incubation periods.
So the 90 days heightened surveillance you talk about, you think the Liberian people are ready or prepared for this? Because anything can happen during this time.
This is why we granularly go into the community level training, community-based event surveillance officers, training district surveillance officers, county surveillance officers, and they are on the watch. We integrating our disease surveillance and respond in all of our districts and communities across the country. So the health team is working with the communities, and communities are reporting events, including cross-border events.
Tolbin Yeswise, Liberia's Assistant Minister for Preventive Services. You are speaking with me from Ganta City, Central Liberia. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, June 10th. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 16 and a half minutes past the hour. Women in Ghana are branching out into traditionally male-dominated industries such as carpentry and taxi driving, and some of them are innovating along the way. Francesca Kekra Fosam has the story for VOA from Accra.
In Ghana today, women are rubbing shoulders with men at work, and not just in the corporate space. Esinam Nyado has gotten used to their looks.
I go like, why? It's because I'm a woman. And for me, in this sort of society, it's a no-go zone area for females to drive a taxi.
So, are you used to the stares now?
Oh, yeah.
She's one of three female taxi drivers in Accra. She calls herself Miss Taxi. She's also a wife, mother of two, and a student at the University of Ghana. Both the loan company and the taxi union rejected her at first.
They weren't sure I would even be able to make up sales or have a good business to pay back their car just because, you know, I'm a woman. And so they were like concerned about whether I wouldn't be open to car hijacking and they will end up losing their assets in the long term.
She now has a devoted clientele, many of them women, and she's innovating. She books her clients via social media, email or text message, and she charges a flat hourly rate. She doesn't haggle like her male counterparts. In Ghana, people say men are better suited to jobs like construction, carpentry, and taxi driving. Those jobs require physical strength and danger. But men may not have the monopoly on toughness. Back in the 19th century, it was a woman, after all, who took the great Asante Empire to war with Ghana's British colonial masters. Yas Antoa, to this day, is a celebrated queen mother of the modern-day Ashanti region. Salina Ajele Anan is a single mother who works as an electrician at Teshi.
And we work on extension boards, kettles, and many things.
She remembers the day she applied for a job.
They dismantled the fluorescent and they asked me to fix it. After I finish it, switch it on, and the board was gone. Now they see that I'm serious.
She says salesmen have started referring clients. Like Miss Taxi, she has found that her gender is actually a draw.
They say, oh, we're a lady. They were surprised. They say, hey, I've never seen a woman electrician before, but you surprised me. So anytime I get any problem, all my friends say they want, I'll call you, and I say, okay. They prefer me working for them than the men.
All her colleagues are men.
The first day she came here, what was it like for you? What did you think?
You know, it's not easy working with women. You know, because women, they always complain a whole lot.
Eric Ajete Otinkrang is one of her superiors. He says there are limits to what Anan can do. Francisca Kakra Forsen for VOA News, Accra.
Cape Verde has one of the most ambitious environmental goals in the world to achieve 100% reliance on renewable energy sources such as wind and solar. Although the previous government set a 2020 deadline on that goal, the current leadership has said it is aiming to achieve 100% reliance in the medium to long term. Jensenio Delgado, a renewable energy expert at the Cape Verde-based ECOWA Center for Renewable Energy and Energy Efficiency, talks to Ricky Stryak about some of the challenges and accomplishments that the country has had so far in their mission.
The government of Cape Verde has established a very ambitious goal for renewable energy, which is to achieve 100% renewable energy penetration electricity production. In 2012, the country achieved about 25% of renewable energy penetration, and we are now about 30%.
And do you have a deadline for when you want to be 100%?
The first deadline was 2020, but now the government revised this deadline. It's not, there is no fixed deadline for 100%. The idea is this is the way that the country has, and depending on different aspects, we can achieve this in a medium long term.
And I know your organization, ECRI, works with both solar and wind. Is that correct? How much is Cabo Verde looking towards solar, and how much are they looking toward wind?
Of course, also, it will depend on the developments on the different technologies. What we have now is more wind energy than solar. But basically, because of the initial cost of solar systems, but the technologies are evolving, and it can be different in the future.
Can you tell me a little bit about what some of the challenges are to achieving this 100% renewable energy goal?
Normally, as you know, due to the variability of the renewable energy, there is technical challenges to go beyond certain level of renewable energy penetration. I would say 30 are bigger when systems are smaller, like in Cape Verde, we have inhabited islands, very small electrical systems.
That was Jensenio Delgado, a renewable energy expert, speaking to Ricky Stryak from Praia, Cape Verde. Thousands of people, black and white, Muslims and Jews, old and young, packed Freedom Hall in Louisville, Kentucky yesterday, Thursday, for a traditional Muslim funeral for Muhammad Ali, the boxing legend who was known by billions around the world, died last week at age 74 after a long fight against Parkinson's disease. A public memorial service will be held today where dignitaries from around the world will pay tribute, will pay their respects. Viewer's Deborah Block went to a boxing gym in Washington, D.C., where some fighters talked about Ali's legacy.
These top amateur and professional boxers sparring at the Washington, D.C. Department of Recreation's Headbangers Gym were not even born when Muhammad Ali was in his prime and winning major heavyweight competitions. But Patrick Harris, who grew up in a boxing family and knew of Ali's triumphs early on, says Ali's influence on his career is undeniable.
I have confidence in what I do, you know. Just, you know, had that mentality that nobody can beat me.
Anthony Peterson says Ali showed him how to be strong.
Never be afraid of your opponent and have fun.
Kazakh fighter Chingizhan Tajibai came to the gym 3 years ago to continue his boxing career in the United States. One of Ali's most famous quotes made an impression on him.
I like his leg moves, like a fly, like a butterfly in the sting, like a bean, you know. That was one of the lessons which I learned.
Raynell Williams thinks Ali's accomplishments were felt around the world.
Because he would go to these different countries and had these big fights.
Head trainer Barry Hunter appreciates that Ali took boxing to a whole new level and made it into what it is today.
Changed boxing forever. He brought the big dollars to boxing. He brought all the star power to boxing. He brought the style to boxing.
Hunter also admires Ali for standing up for his beliefs, especially black pride and defying racial oppression. Police officer Tiara Brown, who won an Olympic gold medal in boxing in 2012, calls Ali inspirational.
He was a civil rights activist, and he was a great athlete. He motivates us to be all that we can be.
18-year-old Duke Reagan says his dad always talked about Ali and said the young Duke reminded him of the great fighter.
And he always said that my dad was strong in my left hand, so he always said that I was gonna be another Muhammad Ali, just a shorter version.
Keithlyn King from the Caribbean country of St. Vincent and the Grenadines says what he respects most about Ali is that he was a good man.
So I try to live something like Muhammad Ali. I try to be good to everybody. That's one thing I love about Muhammad Ali. He was a great, great, great person.
Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa's Pulse. Here is Mark Owoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with athletics. Kenyan Asbel Kiprop clocked 3 minutes and 51.48 seconds to triumph in the 1 mile at the IWF Diamond League in Oslo, Norway on Thursday. Such was the pace in the race that Kenyan runner-up Elijah Manangoi posted a personal best of 3 minutes and 52.04 seconds ahead of Algerian Olympic 1500-meter champion Taufik Makloufi. Kenya's Faith Chepngetich Kipyegon prevailed in the women's 1 mile in 4 minutes and 18.6 seconds. Meanwhile, Hagos Gebrehiwet clocked 13 minutes and 7.70 seconds to lead Edris Mukhtar and Yomif Kejelcha in a 1-2-3 Ethiopian medal podium sweep in men's 5,000 meters. Kenyan Hyvin Kiyeng was victorious in women's 3,000 meters steeplechase in 9 minutes and 9.57 seconds. Ethiopians Sofia Asefa and Etenesh Diro placed second and third, respectively. Turning to football, Egypt host Rwanda in the return leg of the Africa Under-20 Championship qualifier in Cairo today, Friday. Tomorrow, Saturday, South Africa play Namibia, Gabon encounter Angola, Senegal face Tunisia, as defending champions Nigeria are at home to Burundi in Calabar, Cross River State, South-South Nigeria. On Sunday, Ghana host Ethiopia, Republic of Congo engage Burkina Faso, Cameroon encounter Zimbabwe, Lesotho challenge Mozambique, Mali engage Mauritania, Guinea host Ivory Coast, and Morocco play Gambia. In Namibia, Zimbabwe engage Swaziland at the start of the Council of Southern Africa Football Association's COSAFA Cup in the capital Windhoek tomorrow, Saturday. Seychelles will play Madagascar in the other Group A encounter. On Sunday in Group B action, Lesotho face Mauritius and Malawi challenge Angola. Finally, Benin host Equatorial Guinea in the Orange African Cup of Nations qualifier in Cotonou that was postponed to Sunday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Oumai in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend. We'll see you again on Monday morning. Here's our listener mail for this Friday morning, June 10th.
May I use this opportunity to congratulate Mrs. Hillary Clinton for her presidential nominee. Dear Madam, Africa is proud of you and also wish you a very successful victory into the presidential seat. I am Prince John Shea from Obanigo in Obudukate Ranch, Cross River State, Nigeria. Thank you, VOA.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. And that is it for this Friday, June 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good weekend.
Next on Let's Talk, dual citizenship. Would you consider acquiring the citizenship of another country? Join host Sunday Shumari and his guests discussing dual citizenship. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa. Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we will discuss African Liberation Day. Tune into Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC to join host Shaka Saleh and his panels of guests.